Hello there. Today is Friday, August the 9th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, a mother who lost her son to gun violence talks about her efforts to make change.
There is this pattern of pain and destruction and hurt. So that's what these things really cause. They change a community and they rob that person of the life they were supposed to lead.
A dire warning about how our eating habits need to change to save the planet. Also ahead, turning Los Angeles parking lots into safe havens for the homeless. It's all on today's International Edition. The latest mass shootings in the United States has gained significant momentum for reforming gun laws, though the latest national furor over the mass killings last weekend, the tremendous political power of the National Rifle Association, is likely to stymie any major changes to gun laws. Republican Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell Thursday rejected a plea for more than 200 mayors across the U.S. to call the Senate back early to consider gun legislation. But he said he has asked for bipartisan discussions on the matter.
The president called me this morning about this. He's anxious to get an outcome. And so am I, and I believe the Democrats will have to just admit that it's better to get a result than just engage in this sort of endless point scoring that has a tendency to occur after one of these awful, awful incidents.
Well, joining us now to talk more about all of it is Patty Pulete. She is the founder and executive director of the Robbie Pulete Foundation, named after her son who was killed by gun violence 4 years ago at the age of 23. Thank you so much for being with us, and we are genuinely sorry for your loss. Did you think at the time of your son's shooting death that this issue would still not have been addressed?
You know, when something like that happens to you, you can't think past that day. And for 2 years, it was Groundhog Day. You know, I would wake up and I would realize all over again that my son was shot and killed. So when you're a family member, a mother of a gun violence victim, you are stuck in that moment. And every time that something on the news would come up where there was a gun shooting, it reopens those wounds and it deepens those wounds because you know what it's like to get that call that your child has been shot and killed. And you know what that's going to mean for the rest of your life. So, no, I didn't imagine that. But when the mass shooting happened in Sandy Hook and nothing happened after that, that's what made me think we had a real problem here in this country.
Looks like now with these recent shootings, there is a growing call for action. It seems like the public has really had enough. I'm wondering if you think that this is the opportunity to actually make that change.
Well, I was encouraged when I saw the youth gathering and they had March for Our Lives. And it was the youth that were leading the way and saying, enough, we don't want to live this way, and we're not going to raise our children this way, and we're going to be the generation to make a change. That was very encouraging. And then there was kind of a lull, and then this happens. I think what the challenge that we have is we have these headlines that are unbelievable and causes people to react in a way, I can't believe this is happening, and you have those moments of reaction, but it fizzles out. And I think we have to remember that feeling and remember that anger and remember that call to action and have it be a sustainable movement. We're shocked by these mass shootings, and that's what gets the headlines, and that's what gets everyone's attention, because you have a number of deaths at one time in one place. If you look at the United States as one place within our borders, and every single day you have 100 people dying from gun violence, do we not have a mass shooting every single day in this country? That's how I see it. And why don't we react that same way every single day? Gun violence to me, and this goes to why I created the organization I have and the approach we've taken. The issue of gun violence has become such a political issue that no kind of meaningful conversation can be had. And we need to get past that, because this isn't about you're taking my Second Amendment right away. This is about how many lives can we save? How can we prevent these guns from falling into the wrong hands? And both people who love guns versus people who just vehemently hate guns should be working together toward that goal, because this is about lives. This isn't about a gun owner keeping their guns. Even the most staunch gun lover should agree that that gun should not fall into the wrong hands. And so we need to find a way to talk about this subject in a way that's not political but more human, and we're not at that place. So for my foundation, we created a gun buyback program to get as many unwanted firearms off the streets as possible. And then we transformed those guns into art that's used to catalyze these dialogues about gun violence in our communities. And we have a third program that creates career pathways for ex-offenders. Even the gun buyback, which is purely voluntary, is something that I have gotten death threats over. And I can't understand that because I'm not forcing anyone to give me their guns. I'm saying if you're a gun owner and you have a gun just laying around and you don't want that to be susceptible to theft, which can then be used for crime, then here is a safe way to dispose of those firearms. I had a man message me saying he was going to bring me his gun one bullet at a time. And so that's where we are in this country, where it has become such a polarizing political issue.
Do you think that the National Rifle Association, which carries so much weight with the Republican mm-hmm. Party and gives millions of dollars to candidates, mm-hmm. including the president, Donald mm-hmm. Trump, do you think that this is all really because of the National Rifle Association's influence? The Republicans seem hesitant to what would appear get on the bad side of this lobby.
Without a doubt, this is the only country where the NRA has such a stronghold. You don't see that in other countries. It's a big lobby. Of course, if they are giving, investing millions of dollars into their candidates, they will expect their candidates to vote in a certain way. And those candidates will be hesitant not to do it for fear of losing that support for the next election. It's obvious, but it's unfortunate because you see that now with the rhetoric and the pivot to mental illness and video games. You know, it's never about the guns or it's never about how they're falling into the wrong hands. They just find another way around it. And we need to remember the shock and the pain and the disgust that we feel now and carry that through to the next election. That's the only power we have right now, is to look at the legislators that have those dollars behind them and vote them out, if that's truly what we want to do and if we truly want to make a difference.
You know, a lot of people are also talking about the assault weapon ban, that these military-style weapons that can kill a lot of people in a very short period of time, as we just saw, that was the type of gun used by the shooter in Texas.
It's so common sense that it's ridiculous that it's even an argument at this point. They were made for one reason alone, and there's no reason at all for a civilian to have their hands on that. At one of our gun buybacks, you know, we don't ask questions, and that's the draw of it. We don't ask anything of people who surrender their firearms. But this one man brought in an assault weapon, and he shared his story that his son was diagnosed with schizophrenia. He was cleaning his room, and he found the assault weapon sandwiched under his mattress. And he was so afraid of what he was going to do with it, he literally was going to throw it in the river. And his daughter told him, no, I saw a sign for a gun buyback. Go bring it there. And when the local law enforcement saw the gun, they said, this is the same assault weapon that we use to train our SWAT team. And he was able to obtain that off the internet. There is no reason for those types of firearms to be accessible by the general public.
I am certain there must be a tremendous amount of empathy when you see the families suffering after experiencing something so shocking as people going in to buy school supplies in the Walmart and leaving without their loved one.
It brings me back to what I was feeling. You know, my son had laid out a suit on his bed that week that he was killed because he was about to get hired full-time at his job, and it was the suit that we ended up burying him in. These things are not supposed to happen. You know, we are living in such strange and uncivilized times right now that I can't fathom it. And every time I see a news story, whether it's a mass shooting, like I said, or an individual shooting, I automatically think of the parents, and I think of what they have to do. And even if you can't empathize because it's so hard to imagine, think about the implications on not just that household, but that community and that person's work life. It has such a ripple effect that it is so unfathomable. For me, it took me 2 years to even return to the city that I called home for more than 30 years, because that's where my son was killed. And you have this loss of faith, you have this distrust toward your fellow humans, and you just don't know what to do with yourself. I was able to pull myself out and create something in honor of my son, but not everyone has that. And so there is this pattern of pain and destruction and hurt. So that's what these things really cause. They change a community, and they rob that person of the life they were supposed to lead. I always look at someone like Martin Luther King, and we know what we lost when we lost him. We already knew that he was a civil rights leader, but as a mother, we don't even know what we lost when we lose our children, because they had yet to become what they were supposed to be.
That is Patty Pulete. She is the founder and executive director of the Robbie Pulete Foundation. Thank you so much for sharing your story and being with us. The day after the president was visiting with victims and first responders of last weekend's shootings, federal agents arrested 680 undocumented migrants in raids on food processing plants in Mississippi. It was the largest such operation in the United States in 10 years. During a press conference Thursday, officials from U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement's Homeland Security Investigations and the U.S. Attorney's Office for the Southern District of Mississippi, they said that more than 300 people had been released by Thursday morning on humanitarian grounds, including pregnant women and juveniles. Bill Chandler with the Mississippi Immigrant Rights Alliance says community advocates are now trying to find shelters for children who have been stranded without their parents now by the immigration raids.
We have an organization in Canton that's working with the Catholic Church there and with the administration of the city of Canton to try to protect those children, try to get a place for them to go.
Chandler says he believes the raids are racially and politically motivated.
That's all in the name of white supremacy. They don't want people of color. They haven't figured out what to do with African Americans just yet, besides gerrymandering their districts. And now they don't want, they see a future where Latinos and other immigrants will bond together.
The operation had been in the planning stage for about a year, according to officials. Those released on their own recognizance were served with a notice and at some point will have to appear in front of an immigration judge. Nearly all of the 680 migrants picked up are from Latin America. Well, in the wake of the recent shooting tragedies in Texas and Ohio, Democrats running for president have identified their criticism or intensified their criticism of President Trump and what they say is his divisive rhetoric. Trump remains the central issue in the Democratic race, as we hear from VOA national correspondent Jim Malone in Washington.
What's your name?
Rainbow.
Speaking in Iowa, former Vice President Joe Biden accused President Trump of fanning the flames of white supremacy.
Trump readily, eagerly attacks Islamic terrorism, but can barely bring himself to use the words white supremacy. And even when he says it, he doesn't appear to believe it. He seems more concerned about losing their votes and beating back this hateful ideology.
Biden is the current frontrunner for the Democratic Party nomination to run against Trump next year. Several of Biden's rivals were also quick to condemn the president for his past rhetoric, including Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders.
But is somebody who is a racist, who is a sexist, who is a xenophobe, whose anti-immigrant rhetoric, I believe, creates a climate in which violence can take place.
The mass shootings in El Paso and Dayton have unleashed new demands for gun control. And among those demanding action is Democratic presidential contender and New Jersey Senator Cory Booker.
We must act to prevent people who should not have guns from getting them.
It's my honor.
President Trump sought to console victims in El Paso and Ohio this week. And he also fired back at his Democratic rivals.
So my critics are political people. They're trying to make points. In many cases, they're running for president and they're very low in the polls.
Trump's visits drew protesters in both cities, prompting a defense from presidential counselor Kellyanne Conway.
He's speaking to a nation about all this and trying to unify and heal, taking concrete steps. And his political opponents are talking about him.
Democrat lawmakers care more about illegal aliens than they care about their own constituents.
Trump's long record of divisive and provocative comments are coming back to haunt him, says analyst Darrell West.
Trump's rhetoric has contributed to the problem. The country is very divided, certainly along issues of race and immigration. And when he makes all the complaints that he does about immigrants, there are people that are now going out and acting on it.
But in a large Democratic presidential field, some candidates want to focus on Trump more than others, says Vanessa Beasley.
I think what's striking about this year is, you know, the elephant in the room truly is President Trump. And so to the extent that some of them want to talk about President Trump a lot and some of them don't want to talk about him at all, that's what makes this year a little bit different.
The next major test in the Democratic primary race comes in mid-September, when contenders who qualify will gather in Houston, Texas, for a third debate. Jim Malone, VOA News, Washington.
Here are some of the stories we are following at voanews.com. The wife of U.S. student jailed in Iran wants President Trump's help. A Zimbabwean bank alleges loan default by 26 public figures. As police crack down on Moscow protesters, activists are working to ID them. And a Dutch headwear ban is sparking vigilantism fears. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. Witnesses say fears of the Ebola virus have brought border traffic between Rwanda and the Democratic Republic of Congo to a virtual standstill. Long lines and lengthy delays at the border crossings have left many traders frustrated. But officials say health checks are necessary to stop the spread of the deadly virus. Eugene Uwamana was at the border and has the story.
It's around 1 p.m. We are on the Rwanda DR Congo border. Traffic is heavy as usual, but the checks at the crossings have increased because of the Ebola virus. Beatrice Irunga, a 35-year-old Congolese trader, says workers are screening everyone for illness. She says you can't cross the border without washing hands and getting your temperature tested. The measures are necessary to prevent people from carrying the virus across the border. But trade-wise, Ebola fears have hit hard. Many bags of rice and jerry cans of oil are stored on the border. Jemima Ibrahim is a Congolese trader who sells rice and oil in Rwanda. She says the long delays at the crossing are costing her time and money. The loss is huge, she says. We buy goods here in Rwanda. To export them to Congo is becoming very hard. She says we wait with our bicycles for 5 days or 1 week to cross, and we pay as we wait. Claudine Irunga is a Rwandan woman who says she owns a shop in Goma on the Congolese side, but can't reach it because of the delays. I left Goma in the morning, she says. My shop is open now, and here they are not allowing us to go regardless of every document you can have. I'm so sad, she says. They say the border is open, but just look. The Rwandan government estimates that 80,000 people cross between Goma and the Rwandan city of Gisenyi each day. The government has not said the border is closed, but it is urging its people not to enter the eastern DRC, where the Ebola virus has killed more than 1,800 people over the past year. Dr. Diane Gashumba is Rwanda's Minister of Health. She says the lines are very long, but what we even want most is to tell our people not to go to DRC. She says they can look for other ways to do their business in the country. This stance goes against advice from the World Health Organization. Dr. Kasonde Mulenga Mwinga is the WHO country director.
The WHO does not advise on restrictions related to border control. The WHO encourages that there is flow to the member country to be able to address the response that is needed in the country.
The Rwandan and Congolese health ministers met Tuesday to discuss measures to stop the Ebola outbreak from spreading. Afterward, they said they resolved to enact ways that allow for smoother border crossings while taking very strong measures to keep the epidemic at bay. Judging from the scene at the crossing point, health measures are in place and taking precedency over quick and easy border crossings, even if that impedes local business and trade. Eugene Uwimana for VOA News, Rubavu, Western Rwanda.
Climate change is about to hit the world in the stomach, according to the United Nations. A new scientific report from the world body that examines land degradation concludes that climate change will imperil crops and worsen hunger, and it's urging major changes in food production and reducing meat consumption. VOA's Arash Arabasadi has the story.
Historically high temperatures recently caused the largest monthly melt-off of ice in Greenland, an ominous foreshadowing of rising sea levels. A UN study warns that in coming years, climate change also may affect what and how much we have to eat.
Despite increasing food production, an estimated 821 million people are undernourished. In general, climate change will cause declined yields, increased prices, reduced nutrition levels, and disruption in supply chains for food.
Scientists at the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change say that man-made factors challenge the world's fragile ecosystems.
Increasing impacts on land are projected in the future as a result of water scarcity, wildfire, and permafrost thawing. In a warmer climate, the capacity of the land to store the carbon may be reduced.
The panelists are urging an international effort to combat climate change.
Limiting global warming to 1.5 or even 2 degrees will involve removing carbon dioxide from the atmosphere, and land has a critical role to play in carbon dioxide removal.
Scientists say reducing food waste and diversifying agriculture can help blunt the impact.
25 to 30% of food produced is lost or wasted. And reducing food loss and waste can reduce pressure on land, improve food security, and reduce greenhouse gas emissions. At the same time, a move to more balanced diets could help us adapt to and limit climate change.
While not explicitly telling people what to eat, the panel says reducing red meat consumption in favor of plant-based foods could drop as much as 15% from current greenhouse gas emission levels by mid-century. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News, Washington.
And you're listening to International Edition on VOA.
The lyrics could be French,
English,
Portuguese,
Bantu,
Arabic, etc.
It is the beat,
the African beat that counts.
The beat does all the translations.
It cuts across all languages and gives us the understanding that this is the African beat.
It is so distinct
and adhesive.
It binds us together.
African beat on The Voice of America, Mondays through Fridays, 0900 and 2000 Universal Time.
With David Bandy.
Voices. We're talking about the news and issues you're talking about.
Sharing stories of development and growth across Africa,
around the world, and in our lives.
Topics that inform, empower,
and change the rules.
It's time for Our Voices
with me, Haiti Adams Fitzpatrick,
and Hadiza Kiari,
and Ayan Bior,
and Orion Itangi Shaka.
Join us on Facebook at VOA Our Voices.
It's time for Our Voices.
VOA's International Edition continues. There are about 15,000 people in Los Angeles County in California who live in their cars. It's not just uncomfortable, but it's also unsafe. So to make their life a little easier, a nonprofit called Safe Parking LA that was founded in 2016 is creating what they call safe parking lots. Angelina Bagdasarian has the story, narrated by Anna Rice.
For the past 6 months, Zachary Woodworth has been living in his car.
Ball up in here and just try to find a comfortable position to sleep. It's not the easiest thing to do, but it beats laying on the hard pavement or, you know, laying on a piece of cardboard or many of the other things that you see people doing out there.
Woodworth receives a disability allowance, and when he can, he works as a delivery man. But it's not nearly enough to pay for rent in an expensive city such as Los Angeles and the state of California. 6 months ago, Woodworth decided to live in his car for a month. He's still there.
Well, I've been homeless for some time. I was driving around, finding random places to park my car, and it felt really unsafe and really sketchy, and I was always worried about either being confronted by police or someone trying to, you know, rob me.
Stories like Woodworth's inspired social activist Mel Tilakaratne to found a nonprofit called Safe Parking LA.
We provide these lots where they can come in, park from 7 p.m. till 7 a.m. We have a person, a security officer on site to make sure that the participants are protected. We have a porridge on so that for people who need to use the restroom.
For many here, without a car, they'd likely end up sleeping in pop-up tent cities such as this that dot LA's landscape.
The homeless population has increased 12%. So we have about 60,000 people that's homeless in Los Angeles. You have women, you have children, you have veterans, you have the elderly, you have those who have mental health issues.
And the numbers keep increasing, say homeless shelter organizers. There are all kinds of people here. Some aren't even American. Paul is from London.
I had a terrible accident that they didn't want to nurse me back to health. And so they pushed me out of the way. It's a dangerous environment. It's very dangerous.
There's no one reason why people become homeless, but for many here, the story is the same. As historically affordable neighborhoods like Inglewood become more affluent, rents spiked, and residents were left with nowhere to go.
A lot of our clients who seek an emergency service, they became homeless because of the rent increase in Inglewood due to the football stadium. Right? And so we've had numerous of people come here that's from Inglewood. When you think about the 12% ratings, I could say 3% of that came just because of that football stadium.
The city authorities hope that programs such as Safe Parking LA will help those who temporarily found themselves in a difficult life situation. It's not a permanent solution, just one way to help people feel safe for the night. And feeling safe can sometimes be comforting as the homeless try to lift themselves out of a difficult situation. For Angelina Bogdasaran in Los Angeles, NRI's VOA News.
It's raining, it is pouring.
Even celebrities can be starstruck, as was the case with pop icon Ariana Grande when she got to perform in Chicago at the United Center where superstar Barbra Streisand was performing. 26-year-old ended up on stage doing a duet with the 77-year-old icon. The two sung No More Tears, Enough is Enough, which Streisand originally recorded in 1979 with disco star Donna Summer. To get an idea of just how special this was for Grande, a photo is circulating of her as a child of around 12 at a Barbra Streisand concert, gazing with adoration and tears in her eyes as her musical idol sings. Streisand and Grande both posted on social media about how amazing the experience was. Listening to International Edition. That does it for our show today, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. Thank you for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Keith Holmes. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day. Yeah.
This is VOA News. I'm Tom.